And let's go into the sermon then today. Because many of you have used the phrase. Many are saying it in church. Maybe even not you, but many do say it in church every Sunday. Some may say it in prayers every day. But do they really understand what they are saying? Because if they did understand it, maybe they wouldn't use it the way they do. Now, what am I talking about? I'm referring to a phrase which is attributed to Jesus Christ. Quoting from the Authorized Version, the quote-unquote old King James Bible, Christ taught his disciples to pray to God the Father, and I quote, "Lead us not into temptation." But did Christ tell us to pray to the Father in that way, with that kind of a phrase? In order to analyze this, let's go back to the background in Matthew chapter 6. And let's start reading beginning in verse 5. In Matthew chapter 6, beginning in verse 5, Christ is telling us something which then introduces this particular phrase. He says, "When you pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites, for they love to pray standing in the synagogues and on the corners of the streets, that they may be seen by men. Surely I say to you, they have their reward. But you, when you pray, go into your room, and when you have shut your door, pray to your Father who is in secret," or in the secret place, "and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. And when you pray, do not use vain repetitions, as the heathen do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words. Therefore do not be like them, for your Father knows the things you have need of before you ask him. In this manner, therefore, pray." And then, of course, what we read is the so-called Lord's Prayer, as some call it, and many repeat it in services word for word every Sunday, and many repeat it in their prayers on a daily basis, and they do exactly what Christ said not to do. Because Christ says, don't use vain repetitions. When we pray, we need to pray knowing what we're talking about. And all what Christ is doing here now, beginning in verse 9, he is giving you an outline. He is giving you ideas. He is giving you concepts. It's like a skeleton, but you have to fill in the flesh, so to speak. Because he says, in this manner, therefore, pray. He's not saying repeat these words time and time and time and time again until they become meaningless. But he says, in this manner, therefore, pray. And then dropping down to verse 13, he says, "And do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from evil." Do not lead us into temptation is how this is translated here. But as it is translated here, this would be a rather strange request of God the Father. Because what does this phrase tell you? What kind of an implication does it have for you? What would you say it means? Well, wouldn't it say that God would perhaps tempt us and we are asking God not to tempt us? But why should we ask God not to tempt us? See, the problem is with the translation here. In the New King James Bible, in the Authorized Version, and so on, because that translation is very misleading. Let's go with me, please, to the book of James, chapter 1. James chapter 1, let's start reading in verse 13. It says in James chapter 1, and James, of course, is the half-brother of Jesus Christ, and he's telling us here, "Let no one say, when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone." So we find here that the Bible is very clear on this point. God does not tempt us. He doesn't tempt us to sin. So therefore, he would never actively do something to induce us or to tempt us to sin. From this, it follows that Christ did not ask us to pray to the Father, "Don't tempt us to sin," or "Don't bring temptation into our lives." because it would be totally against God's character to do that in the first place. However, God allows things to happen. He allows us to do as we please. He doesn't force us not to sin. And he does not at this point change the society around us, nor has he removed Satan from his earthly throne. And this means influences in our lives exist which may tempt us to sin. And so we are to ask God to restrain those influences so that we are not tempted to sin. We shouldn't allow ourselves to be in situations where we are tempted to sin or to do evil. We are even told to avoid all appearance of evil. We are told to flee fornication, for example. So we are supposed to stay out of situations which might tempt us to sin. But what did Christ say here in Matthew 6? Keep your finger here in James, though. But let's go back to Matthew 6 in our minds. Did he actually say that we should pray to the Father, "Don't lead us into temptation"? The Lamsa Bible translates this phrase as follows: "Do not let us enter temptation." Do not let us enter temptation. The Godspell Bible says, "Do not subject us to temptation." What these translations point out is the fact that we are supposed to ask God to prevent us from entering or walking into tempting situations which might lead us to sin. I have here a comment from the Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown commentary, which explains this passage this way. "We take it as a prayer against being drawn or sucked of our own will into temptation, to which the word here seems to lend some countenance, because it is literally translated, 'Introduce us not.' It's still something we are allowing to happen in our lives. It's not something which God makes us do. What is it what tempts us to sin? Let's go back to the book of James, chapter 1, and let's start reading in verses 14 and 15. James chapter 1, beginning in verse 14 now. He has just said, God isn't the one who's tempting you. At verse 14, "But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires and enticed. Then when desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death." Because the penalty of sin, as we know, is death. So James here tells us that we are tempted when we are drawn away by our own desires and enticed by them. In other words, when we give in to our desires rather than fighting them, rather than overcoming them, then we sin. The temptation of our own desires causes us to sin because we were unable or unwilling to resist our own desires. Notice Matthew chapter 26. In Matthew chapter 26, we are, of course, introduced to the time when Christ was in the garden praying to God for help and strength that he could go through that cup which was prepared for him. And he told his disciples to pray with them. But the disciples were tired. It was late at night. And so they fell asleep. And Christ came back here and in Matthew chapter 26. And in verse 41, he's telling them, "Watch and pray, lest you enter into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak." The parallel scripture in Luke, you might just want to jot this down, chapter 22 and verse 40 actually tells us, "Watch and pray that you don't enter into temptation." Christ is emphasizing the point that we need additional strength from God so that we don't give in to the temptations of our own flesh and sin. Even though our spirit might be willing, we might have a good motive, good intent, good heart, unless we are very careful and unless we have that additional strength from God, we will give in to our fleshly desires and sin. Paul also warned us to have the strong, or not to have, rather, the strong desire to become rich, as so many in this day and age do have that desire. Notice 1 Timothy chapter 6. Now, we know in the Bible that there are several scriptures and examples where people have become rich because God blessed them. Now, this is not what we're talking about here, but there are some who actually do want to become rich for the wrong reasons. And notice 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 9. Again, he's talking about desire here. And he's also putting or shedding some light on how we enter temptation, how that happens. 1 Timothy chapter 6 and verse 9. He says, but those who desire to be rich fall into temptation. See, God doesn't put them there. They fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. We might even be tempted by our own desires to sin if we fail to look at ourselves and our own spiritual condition when we are trying to help someone else to overcome his or her spiritual problems. Now, that might perhaps be surprising, but in Galatians chapter 6, Paul warns us to be careful even in regards to that situation. Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1. Paul is saying here, brethren, Galatians chapter 6 and verse 1, brethren, if any man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. How can this be? Oh, in many different ways. For instance, I'm spiritual. I'm going to show this guy how wrong he is. See, and pride comes in. And pride, of course, is a sin. So we are tempted to sin by trying, quote-unquote, to help somebody else in his or her spiritual weakness. Or another way of how to understand this would be very careful, because even though you might not have committed that very sin right now, given the same circumstances and conditions, you might very well do the same thing. So be very careful that you are not tempted by thinking you could never do that. And of course, again, the pride concept comes in again. So it's our own desires which may tempt us to sin if we don't control them. But of course, then there is another influence which tempts us to sin. When we turn to the book of 1 Thessalonians, chapter 3, here again the Apostle Paul is telling us what other influence that might be. 1 Thessalonians, chapter 3, beginning in verse 4. The context here is tribulations. People went through a lot of trial. And Paul, who was not present, was wondering whether those trials actually had discouraged the people and whether they had actually given up because of those trials. And so in 1 Thessalonians 3 and verse 4, he says, for in fact, we told you before when we were with you that we would suffer tribulation just as it happened, and you know. For this reason, when I could no longer endure it, I sent to know your faith. He wanted to find out, have they still kept faithful to God's word, to God's truth? Or was the trial so bad for them that they just gave up? In order to know that, he says, I sent to know your faith, lest by some means the tempter. And other passages point out that Satan, the devil, is called the tempter. So lest by some means the tempter had tempted you. Had tempted you to do what? Well, to give up. To go back into the world. To say, well, that's too hard for me. I can't handle that anymore. So Paul wanted to make sure that the tempter hadn't tempted them to give up this way of life. And he says, and our labor might be in vain. So Satan is right there trying to tempt us whenever he can, in whatever situation we might be in order to make us give up this way of life. You see, God never tempts us to sin. But Satan likes nothing more than to tempt us, to induce us to sin. And so Paul even has a warning here for married couples, and I emphasize married couples, in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Now, even that is, at first sight, perhaps a strange comment, unless you start thinking about it, what Paul is talking about here. 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 5. Here Paul is saying, 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 5, do not deprive one another. And the context is here sexual relationships. Do not deprive one another except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer. In other words, sometimes, you know, you need some time for yourself to do that. And come together again. So that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. Come together again. He's talking about a sexual relationship here. What's he talking about? He's talking to married couples. He's telling married couples not to allow Satan to tempt them to commit a sexual sin, including the sin of adultery, because both partners don't show the mutual sexual affection for each other in their marriage. We see again how Satan can take advantage even of a situation like that. It shows the absolute satanic concept of forced celibacy. It is totally opposed to God's word. And so Satan comes right in. And Satan is able to do that. And if we are not careful, we fall right into his trap. We also know that Satan tempted Jesus Christ in the wilderness for 40 days and for 40 nights. In Matthew 4, and I'm not going there right now, but in Matthew 4 we find that Satan there is called the tempter. But I'd like to turn to Luke chapter 4 and notice in Luke chapter 4 how this temptation of Christ is described here. Because some have the idea that Satan just had those three quote-unquote temptations and that's all he ever did. And Satan then would never ever tempt Christ again for the rest of his life. That's totally false. Totally a false concept. Notice Luke chapter 4 and verse 13. It says, now when the devil had ended every temptation he wanted to bring about on Christ during those 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, when he had ended every temptation, he departed from him until an opportune time. You see, Satan hadn't given up yet. Satan was still at Christ throughout Christ's earthly life here, trying to tempt him whenever he could. And sometimes he would use people. Sometimes he would even use Christ's own disciples. In one case, he used Peter. And Peter said to Christ, when Christ told him that he would have to go through the trial of crucifixion and the torture he had to go through, and Peter says, oh, no, that shouldn't happen to you. And Christ says to Peter, get behind me, Satan. Calls him Satan. Because at that moment, Peter was influenced by Satan. He says, you desire the things which are of man. You don't desire the things which are of God. So Satan tried time and time again to tempt Christ, either directly or through the people he could use. And so the third influence, if you please, which is tempting us to sin, is the society we live in. The people we are in contact with. See, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians tempted Christ on numerous occasions. We read that they came tempting him, that he would show them a sign from heaven. He said, well, if you are really the Son of God, you show us a sign. And that's exactly what Satan tried to tell Christ. If you're the Son of God, you know, you make those stones to become bread. And if Christ had done that, he would have been nothing else but a magician, so to speak. So he knew that that wasn't what he was supposed to do. And so then he used the Pharisees to kind of tempt them the same way, to try to tempt Christ the same way, saying, oh, well, show us a sign from heaven. That will prove to us that you are the Son of Man. And also in Matthew 22 and verse 18, if you read it in the Authorized Version, they came to him and they asked him, well, do we really have to pay taxes to Caesar? And it was a trick question. And Christ answers and says to them, why do you tempt me, you hypocrites? He tells them, you know, you are hypocrites. You know better than that. But you try to tempt me. Why do you try to do that? So Satan tempts us to sin. Our own desires tempt us to sin. And the society, the people of this world, try to tempt us to sin. Of course, being influenced by Satan in one degree or another. God never tempts us to sin. However, God tests us. He tests us in order to help us not to sin. That is the fundamental difference between Satan and God. Satan tempts us to sin. God tests us so we don't sin. Sometimes his tests, though, can be very difficult. And so here is another way how we can understand Christ's admonition to us regarding our prayer to the Father. For instance, the Jewish New Testament by David Stern translates this phrase in this way. Do not lead us into heart testing. Do not lead us into heart testing. And that is also an accurate translation from the Greek, because here's why. And that's why it's getting confusing to some, specifically some translators who have to make a decision what word they want to use here. Because in the Greek, as well as in the Hebrew, the word for temptation and for trial is the same word. And also the word for to tempt and to test is the same word. And so every time you have this Greek word, or every time you have this Hebrew word, the translator has to make a decision. What word am I going to use here? Do I use the word tempt, or do I use the word test? Do I use the word temptation, or do I use the word trial? The context most of the time clearly dictates what word to use and what not to use. For instance, if you know that God doesn't tempt you and that God cannot be tempted, as we have just read in the book of James, you cannot use the word tempt in relationship to God. Now, some, as we will see, have never focused on that distinction and still have translated it that way and have done it in the wrong way. For you who want to check this out, the word temptation in Greek is pyrasmos, and that can mean temptation, it can mean trial. The Greek word for to tempt is pyratzo. It can mean test, it can mean tempt. In the Hebrew word for temptation is masa, and it can also mean trial. And the word for to tempt is nazar, and it can also mean to test. So as I said, the word can be used either way. And you have to look at the context to see what word is meant. And that's why David Stern translates it here, and do not lead us into heart testing. Because, as I said, the word can mean temptation, the word can mean testing, depending on the context. In this particular case, both is possible, as we will see. Now, first of all, let me say that we want God to test us. We want God to test us because we are supposed to become stronger spiritually, and we are supposed to become approved in his eyes. But at the same time, Christ is asking us to pray the Father not to make it too hard for us. Notice Jeremiah chapter 10, because Jeremiah uttered that same prayer. Don't make it too hard for us, or for me. Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 24. He wasn't saying to God, oh, don't do anything in my life, don't correct me, don't test me, but he said, don't make it too difficult. Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 24. Jeremiah is saying, oh, Lord, correct me, but with justice, not in your anger, lest you bring me to nothing. It's another way of saying, don't make it too difficult for me. David has the same prayer. In Psalm chapter 6, Psalm chapter 6 and verse 1. In Psalm chapter 6 and verse 1, he says, Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger, nor chasten me in your heart's displeasure. Have mercy on me, O Lord, for I am weak. So the other passage is where he says, remember that I am just dust. So again, we are to be tested by God, but at the same time, our prayer should be, don't make it too tough for us. And as we see in a moment, and give us help when we are in it. But we should never want to escape from God's testing. We shouldn't ask God not to test us at all, because we should know that God has to test us. He has to correct us when we need correction. Since we are in the book of Psalms, let's go to Psalm 26 and verse 2 and notice again how David prayed to God. Psalm 26 and verse 2. Here the New King James Bible says, examine me, O Lord, and prove me. But then they put in the margin, or test me. Try my mind and my heart. Now the New American Bible says it a little bit more accurately. Test me, Lord, and try me. Search my heart and my mind. So we should ask God, we should want God to test us, to try us. Because if there are problems, we want them to be corrected in our lives. And so we find that God has always tested his people. Let's go back to the book of Genesis, chapter 22. Now, this was an extremely difficult test we are reading about now. But God knew, because you see, God is searching the heart and the mind. God is not going to test you in a way which you couldn't handle. And so he knew that Abraham could pass this test we are reading about here in Genesis chapter 22, verse 1, although many today, I would say, would not be able to handle that test. Because he asked Abraham to sacrifice his own son. Now, this was a test. God never intended of Abraham to do that. But he wanted to see whether Abraham was willing to give everything up when it came to what his priority in life was. And so in Genesis chapter 22 and verse 1, we read, now it came to pass after these things, and I'm reading from the New King James Bible, that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. And then he tells him, take your only son and sacrifice him to me as a burnt offering. Notice it says in the New King James Bible that God tested him. The Authorized Version has here that God tempted him. A totally wrong translation. Blatantly false. Because you see, God doesn't tempt anyone. So that's why here it has to say God tested Abraham. Notice Hebrews chapter 11, which is a parallel passage in the New Testament commenting on this test. Hebrews 11 and verse 17. And here even the Authorized Version has it correctly. But I'm reading from the New King James. Hebrews 11 and verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said, and Isaac your seed shall be called. Notice though, concluding that God was able to raise him up even from the dead, from which he also received him in a figurative sense. Abraham knew God had promised him that through Isaac his seed would be blessed. So therefore, Abraham knew that promise had to be fulfilled. He had no doubts that God would fulfill it. And even if he had to go through with killing his own son, he knew that God would have to raise him up immediately to fulfill that promise that through Isaac his seed would be blessed. Because at that time Isaac didn't have children yet. And that happened. But it was a very, very tough test. But God didn't tempt him to sin. God tested him to, as we will see in a moment, do good to him in the end. God told Moses that he would test the nation of Israel. Notice why God tests us. Exodus chapter 16 and verse 4. Exodus chapter 16 and verse 4. The Lord said to Moses, Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain quota every day, that I may test them whether they will walk in my law or not. This test had to do with Sabbath keeping, because, amongst other things, because God sent manna down from heaven, but on what we would call Friday today, he sent twice a portion, and he didn't send anything on the Sabbath. And he told him, now you don't go out on the Sabbath and gather the wood, or gather the bread rather, because I have provided for you on Friday. And some didn't keep that command. And so they went out, even on the Sabbath. Not only wasn't there anything to gather, secondly, God became very angry with them for disobeying his command. So this had to do with, are they willing to obey my law? In this case, the law regarding the Sabbath. And he also told them, you know, you don't gather more than you need. You only gather as much as you need and don't keep it for the next day. And some, of course, disobeyed that. And so they kept it for the next day. And then the bread began to stink because it was not meant to stay and remain longer as just one day. And so God was testing them in this regard as well. But he wasn't tempting them. See, he wasn't tempting them so that they would sin. He tested them so that they would not sin. He tested them to see whether they would walk in his law. That's the reason for God's testing today when he's testing you. He's testing you to see, are you willing to obey him or not? In Deuteronomy chapter 13, his testing would even involve something which could be really difficult for some to handle, and frankly, some have not handled it correctly. In Deuteronomy chapter 13, let's start reading in verse 1. If there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder comes to pass. So here is a prophet, a dreamer of dream, a quote-unquote magician, if you please, a miracle worker, and he is actually saying, okay, I'm going to give you a sign, and that sign comes to pass. And everybody would think, oh, well, now this has got to be a godly man. I mean, God is giving him the power to bring about that sign. But just the opposite is true, because it goes on to say in verse 2, the sign and the wonder comes to pass of which he spoke to you, saying, let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them. So he is this false prophet, and he is backed up, so to speak, by a sign, but he is trying to tell the people to turn their back on the true God. What does God say in verse 3? You shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams, for the Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul. Again, God allows that even to happen, to test us, making sure that we will obey him and reject this false prophet. The time will come where many in this world won't do that at all. There is a false prophet mentioned in the Bible who will bring about miracles, so much so that he can even ask for fire to come down from heaven. And many will follow him, thinking that he is the man of God, the representative of Christ here on earth. And God says, you don't follow that man, because he is turning you away from me. I want to make sure that you follow me. Even at the time of the judges, notice Judges chapter 2, God would test the nation of Israel through society, if you please. But again, not so that they would sin, but so that they would not sin. Judges chapter 2, verses 20 and 21. We read here, I will also no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, so that through them I may test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of the Lord, to walk in them as their fathers kept them, or not. It's the same as us today. God hasn't taken us, out of this world. Christ says, I'm not taking them out of the world. They're still in the world. We are still here. We still have to overcome the temptations of society. And at the same time, God is testing us to see how good we are doing, or how easy we fall into the trap of doing what everybody else is doing. And so here, God did the same thing. He left those pagan nations around them to see how Israel would be doing, because they overall miserably failed the test, as we know from history. God wants us to do a lot better than what ancient Israel did. But notice now in Deuteronomy chapter 8 as to why God is testing us. Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 16. And to get the context, it's rather a long sentence here. Let's start with verse 11 and then I'll jump down to verse 16. But in verse 11 it says, "Beware that you do not forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, his statutes, which I command you today." You see, how do we forget God? How do we turn our back on God? By not keeping his commandments. And then it goes down to verse 16. "God fed you in the wilderness with manna." We just read about that earlier, how he sent bread from heaven. "He fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers didn't know, that he might humble you and that he might test you." Why? "To do you good in the end." God's testing is for the purpose of doing us good in the end, because we become stronger through those tests. We become more reliable. God looks at us and says, "Well, this person becomes more and more worthy of me because he is passing those tests." Now, if you flunk each and every test, maybe a problem. But also in Exodus chapter 20, we again find why God is testing us. It's just the opposite mentality as what Satan the devil has. Exodus 20 and verse 20. "Moses said to the people, 'Do not fear, for God has come to test you, and that his fear may be before you, so that you may not sin.'" Why is God testing us? So that we may not sin. Not so that we will sin. That would be temptation. That's what Satan is trying to do. That is not at all what God is doing. And because of that, because we understand that God is testing us to do us good, God is testing us to make us stronger, God is testing us so that we don't sin, we should actually welcome tests, how difficult and how hard it might be. But notice James chapter 1, going back to the book of James now. But with that background, we perhaps better understand why James is saying here what he's saying. James chapter 1, beginning in verse 2. "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into various trials." Why? "Knowing that the testing of your faith produces patience, long suffering." And then there's a whole list of things which are all being produced through tests. And then finally, let's drop down to verse 12. "Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him." Now, as I said earlier, the word for temptation is the same word as the word for trial. And so it's totally legitimate to translate this passage here in James 1 and verse 12 differently. And so the New Jerusalem Bible translates it as follows. "Blessed is anyone who perseveres when trials come. Such a person is of proven worth and will win the prize of life, the crown that the Lord has promised to those who love him." It seems to me that that is a better translation in this context, because God is testing us to see out of what metal we are made, and the purpose of the test, the trial, is to do us good in the end. Notice what Peter tells us in 1 Peter 1, verses 6 and 7. 1 Peter 1, verses 6 and 7. "In this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while, if need be, if need be. You have been grieved by various trials, that the genuineness of your faith, being much more precious than gold that perishes, though it is tested by fire, may be found to praise, honor, and glory at the revelation of Jesus Christ. So again, we find that the trials which God sends us will lead to becoming a stronger person. Our faith is becoming more purified, becoming more genuine. And that is why we should greatly rejoice when we fall into trials, which then enable us to prove to God that we are willing to walk worthy of Him. But what we shouldn't ask God then is to allow us to sin against Him by testing Him. Now, God is testing us for a good purpose, but many people try to test Him. Now, we cannot tempt God, because James tells us that God cannot be tempted, but we can test Him. We can put Him to the test. We can try to try Him exceedingly. And the Bible contains many examples where people have tried to do that. Notice, for instance, in Hebrews chapter 3. Hebrews chapter 3, verses 8 and 9. Hebrews chapter 3, beginning in verse 8. Do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion, in the day of trial in the wilderness, where your fathers tested me, tried me, and saw my works 40 years. So the ancients have tried and tested God, even though they saw His works for 40 years. In what way did they do it? How did they test God? Notice Psalm 78. And let's look at verses 41 and 42. Psalm 78, verse 41. Now here again, a typical wrong mistranslation in the New King James. Didn't check the authorized version, but I'm pretty sure they have it wrong too. Because here it says in Psalm 78 and verse 41, yes, again, they tempted God. Now, we cannot tempt God. God cannot be tempted. So we know that is a wrong translation. It has to mean, yes, again and again, they tested God. And that's how many of the modern translations have it, like the New Revised Standard Version says, they tested God again and again. But the point is here, how did they test Him? How did they test Him? Well, let's keep reading. Yes, again and again, they tested God and limited the Holy One of Israel, verse 42, they didn't remember His power the day when He redeemed them from the enemy. How did they test Him? By doubting Him. By limiting in their minds His power. By saying, oh, well, God cannot do that for me. Well, He might have brought us some, you know, water perhaps in the wilderness, but He can't bring us something to eat. He cannot rescue us from our enemies. We have to fight ourselves. And on and on and on the reasoning went. They tested Him, they putting Him to test in their minds by doubting Him, by limiting His powers for them. And so notice also in verses 18 and 19 of the same psalm, and here, interestingly enough, even the New King James says it correctly now by saying testing. Now, why they translated tempting in verse 41, only the translator would know that one. But in Psalm 78 and verse 18 it says, and they tested God in their hearts by asking for the food of their fancy. Yes, they spoke against God and said, can God prepare a table in the wilderness? So how did they test Him in their mind? By saying, well, is God really willing to help us? Is God really able to help us? Can God really do that? And worse than that, they even tested God in their mind by wondering whether He was even still among them. Notice Exodus chapter 17 and verse 7. After all the miracles God had done for them, they asked the question, is God actually with us? and things didn't quite go the way they had expected. Exodus 17 and verse 7. It says, "So he calls the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the contention of the children of Israel, and because they," and again, wrong translation, "tempted the Lord." It should obviously say tested the Lord. The margin even says it should say tested the Lord. But in the original, they say still say tempted, in the original translation, that is. But they didn't tempt. But they tested the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" The New Revised Standard Version says here correctly, "He calls the place Massah and Meribah because the Israelites quarreled and tested the Lord, saying, 'Is the Lord among us or not?'" So they even asked the question, "Is God still with us?" because things didn't quite go the way they had expected them to go. That should teach us a lesson, shouldn't it? Sometimes things don't go the way we expect them to go. And we may ask the question, "Well, is God really still in our life? Or has God moved away?" Well, God would only move away if you move away from Him. But as long as we do what God wants us to do, we can be rest assured and absolutely and totally convinced God is still in our lives, even though things might not quite go the way which we expect them to go. The Bible tells us never to test God in such a way. You see, when Satan asked him in the wilderness to do certain things, Christ's famous reply to Satan could be translated, "Do not put the Lord your God to the test." You see, if Christ said to Satan that we shouldn't tempt God, then that would again be a wrong translation, because you see, you can't tempt God, but you can put Him to the test. And so in Matthew chapter 4 and verse 7, that is exactly how most translations now translate it. The New Revised Standard, the Revised English Bible, the New American, the New Jerusalem Bible, they all say that Christ told Satan, "It is written, do not put the Lord your God to the test." So we are not to put God to the test by trying to force Him to do something in accordance with our will. You see, Satan tempted Christ to sin against God by saying, "Oh, you throw yourself down from the pinnacle of the temple, and God will help you." In other words, you throw yourself down, and then you will have to force God to intervene and help you. And Christ said, "If I do that, I would be sinning against God, because I am putting Him to the test. I'm trying to enforce my will on Him, rather than being subject to His will." And we must never do that. Notice 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, let's read verses 8 and 9. Start in verse 8. "Nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ," again a terrible mistranslation. Now the margin has here "test Christ," and that's how it should be. "Nor let us test Christ, as some of them also tested and were destroyed by the serpents." Now here we are talking about a time when Christ was the immortal spirit God being in Old Testament times. He was God, and as such could not be tempted, but He could be tested. And so the New Revised Standard Version again has it correctly. They translate, "We must not put Christ to the test, as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents." In other words, they quote-unquote tested Christ. And some of us, perhaps even today, may test Christ. The personage in the God family who dealt directly with ancient Israel in the Old Testament times, who is dealing directly with us today. They tested Him by questioning His purpose for their lives and by complaining that Christ had not provided them with food and water. Notice this in Numbers chapter 21, because that's a reference here in the Old Testament passage, Numbers 21, verses 4 to 6, notice what happens. Numbers 21, verses 4 to 6. Then they journeyed from Mount Hor by the way of the Red Sea to go around the land of Edom, and the soul of the people became very discouraged on the way. And the people spoke against God. Jesus Christ, the one who dealt directly with them at the time, they spoke against God and against Moses. Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food and no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread or detests it. And so notice what Christ did. So the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people. And many of the people of Israel died. Here was the question, why has God done that? Why has he brought us out of Egypt? Why is he going to let us die in the wilderness? Total lack of faith, a total lack of memory. Totally forgotten about the fact that he got them through the Red Sea, that he performed that miracle of opening the Red Sea, letting them go through, and then drowning all the Egyptians who tried to bring them back into slavery. Totally forgotten all of that. And Christ says, be very careful that you don't fall into the trap, because if you do, you also might die, as these people here did die. And our death would be an eternal one. So it's a very, very strong warning. Peter asked even certain church elders at the time of the first conference in Jerusalem. Let's go to Acts chapter 15. He even asked certain church elders at the time not to test God by putting a yoke on the neck of the disciples, by insisting that Gentiles must become circumcised and keep the Old Testament rituals of the sacrificial system if they want to become members of the church. Notice Acts chapter 15 and verse 10 what Peter is saying. Now therefore, why do you test God by putting a yoke on the neck of the disciples which neither our fathers nor we were able to bear? And what was that yoke? First chapter 15, verse 1. Certain men came down from Judea and taught the brethren, unless you are circumcised, according to the custom of Moses, you cannot be saved. You see, but God had already brought the Gentiles into the church, and they were not circumcised. God had not required Cornelius and his household to become circumcised. God had already shown them that he accepted them in an uncircumcised, physically speaking, fashion. But these people went back and said, yeah, but they still got to be circumcised. And God says, why do you test God by putting that yoke on the neck of the disciples? Got to be very careful again that we don't impose restrictions on God's people, which God doesn't impose in the Bible. Let me summarize up to this point what we have discussed. When we ask God the Father to protect us from temptation or serious and sore trials, we understand that God never tempts us to sin. Rather, temptation to sin comes through our own desires. It comes through our society in which we live. And it comes, of course, through Satan, the devil. Christ tells us to ask the Father to protect us from temptation to sin. But we also understand that God tests us to get to know us better. He tests us for the purpose of strengthening us and enabling us more and more not to sin. So we shouldn't ask God the Father to withhold tests from us, but Christ tells us to ask the Father not to allow trials to come upon us which might be too difficult for us to bear. We should also ask the Father for strength and wisdom never to test him by doubting him, by doubting his powers, by limiting his ability to help us in our own minds, by trying to force our own will upon God, and even by questioning his involvement in our lives. But now what if we find ourselves in temptations? What if we find ourselves in sore trials? You see, God doesn't only help us not to get into temptations, but if we find ourselves in them, for whatever reason, God also helps us to get
out of them.
We might have entered the realm of temptation because we gave in to our own selfish desires, or we might not have resisted the influences of Satan the devil, or the society that surrounds us in the way we should have. Or in accordance with God's plan, he lets Satan tempt us. But insofar as God is concerned, he uses this opportunity to test us. You see, Satan wanted to tempt Job to sin. But God allowed it. While at the same time, he was testing Job for the purpose of making him stronger spiritually. When in temptation, or in a very difficult trial, we can be delivered out of it. God promises us that he will deliver us from evil, including temptation, including sore, difficult trials, if we really want him to. Notice 1 Corinthians chapter 13. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 13. Let me just read it first of all the way it's written here in the New King James. No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to men, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it, or that you may be able to endure it. In this case, it could also be translated differently, like the Revised English Bible has it. Because remember now, the word for temptation and for trial is the same in the Greek. It's up to the translator to decide which word to use. And the Revised English Bible says it this way: so far you have faced no trial beyond human endurance. God keeps faith and will not let you be tested beyond your powers. But when the test comes, he will at the same time provide a way out and so enable you to endure. So it goes both for temptations and it goes for trials. God is helping us either way when we find ourselves in them. We also notice in 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 9. The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations. And again, as you guessed it, other translations have here, correctly so. It's another way of putting it. God knows how to deliver the godly out of their trials. Because again, both statements here would be correct, because God does both things. Now, we find in the book of Hebrews that Jesus Christ had to go through temptations as well as trials. Notice Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 18. In Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 18 we read, "For in that he himself has suffered, being tempted," and then the margin says, "or tested, he is able to aid those who are tempted or tested." And also notice Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15. "For we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses, but was in all points tempted as we are, yet without sin." Now here, particularly in Hebrews 4, I feel that the word tempted here is the most likely rendering, because the context here is sin. He says he was tempted in all points as we are, but yet without sin. Now, I said earlier, God couldn't be tempted, so how can I say that Christ was tempted when he was here on earth? Simply because Christ became a human being while he was here on this earth. We read in John 1 and verse 14 that he became flesh. At that time, when he was here on earth, Christ was tempted in all points as we are, because he laid aside his divinity. He was no longer this divine, immortal, spirit, God being he had been. He became a man, and as such, he could be tempted. So he was tempted in all points as we are. He was also tested in all points as we are, and he passed all tests with flying colors. He didn't fail once. He never, ever sinned. So Jesus Christ was both tested and tempted, and he can help us. He can deliver us from sin, from our temptations, from our trials. So when we ask God the Father to deliver us from temptations or from very serious, sore trials in our lives, we should also realize that Jesus Christ is there as our high priest to help us in those times of need. And so let me in conclusion now read the final scripture in Hebrews chapter 4 and in verse 16. Because when we slip, brethren, Christ is right there to pick us up so that we can get going. There's never a reason for us to give up. Even if times get tough, we have the promise that God the Father and Jesus Christ are there to help us, to deliver us, to not let trials come upon us and even temptations which are too difficult for us to bear. And so we read now in Hebrews chapter 4 and in verse 16, after we just read that Christ was tempted in all points as we are, yet without sin, in verse 16 we read, "Let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace." Don't give up. Don't walk the other way. No, just the opposite. You come to God in prayer. You ask Him boldly with confidence, with reassurance for that help. That we may, it says, obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. God is there to help us. He is only, as we said so many times, just one prayer away.